This is an ABC podcast.
Love on the Spectrum follows a group of young adults on the autism spectrum as they look for romantic love. They're coached in dating and relationships by Jodie Rogers. With Jodie, they run through what to do on a first date, how to flirt, and what to do when the other person doesn't feel the same way. Now, frankly, these are things most of us could do with some help with. Jodie is a sexologist and a counsellor, and she's known since she was a teenager that she wanted to work with people with disabilities. Or as Jodie's daughter described it when she was a little girl, "My mum works with people with possibilities." Hi, Jodie.
Hi, Sarah.
Who did your daughter say that to?
I was picking her up from childcare, so she was very young, maybe 3, I think. And the people at the childcare said, "Oh, Jodie, come in and see this funny thing that Sage, my daughter, had drawn." So, you know, at that age, they draw a picture and tell a story. And she'd drawn, you know, a childish drawing of me, and underneath it had obviously tried to say disabilities but didn't know the word. So I had said, "When I grow up, I want to be exactly like my mum and work with people with possibilities." So, which I think is beautiful, and just how children do it, really. They actually tell the truth in kind of a strange way.
Is that how you see the clients you work with, people with possibilities?
I've lived my whole life and hung out my whole life with people with disabilities, so I sometimes don't even see any difference than how I would see anybody else. And I think that all of us have got great potential to live great lives, and so I don't see it any differently for people that I work. I have very high expectations of people to live well and want them to live well. So, yeah, for me it's not really a this and them, a them and us sort of thing. Yeah, that's the best way I can really say it. But yes, possibilities, we've all got them.
How did you end up getting a gig on this groundbreaking TV show, Love on the Spectrum?
That's a little bit weird, actually, because it's much more of who you know than what you know. I'd love to say it's about everything I know, but in actual fact, it's not. So it was one of those weird situations where somebody that I know knew somebody from ABC. They were talking about a show and my friend said, "Oh, have you ever met or heard of Jodie?" And interestingly, I was presenting at a sexologist conference in Sydney around the same time, and so the Northern Pictures people asked me to come in and meet them. I thought I was going in to meet them to help them find some more autistic people to be on the show, which I think they thought too. But then when I got in there, they started chatting with me about what I do for my work, and I don't know what happened. Within a couple of hours, they sent me a message saying, "Do you want to be on the show?" Which I thought, no way.
Really?
In hell.
Why?
Oh, no.
Why?
Way. Well, there's a couple of things. One, I've never been on television, so that's random. But the other one is that it's, you know, I hold my job to a really high standard. I'm a therapist and a counsellor, and so it's a really unique situation to be in. You want to build a genuine relationship, because that's what counselling is all about, and it's very intimate talking about these things. And so in my mind, I was thinking, I don't want to be in that vulnerable position to be filmed doing my work. So I had to let that go. But I've got a really fantastic sister who basically said to me, you know, who else is going to do this? And you've got something to say, and this is about the greater good. She basically said to me, this is about the greater good. And so, yeah.
She knew how to press your buttons, didn't she? This is for the greater good, Jodie.
Yeah, okay. She does. She knows me very, very well. But, yeah, I think it's one of those things that once I thought I'd be on for one episode on the ABC for
who watches
four
that, for God's
exactly.
sake?
Exactly.
And now you're on Netflix all over the world.
Exactly.
What happened on the first day of filming, Jodie? Tell me about that.
Oh, because just as I was saying to you, I've never been on television. So I had this really funny image in my head that what happened was that when you were filmed, people made you beautiful. So I basically, because I don't live in Sydney, and the first time, the first episode on the first season, I'm with Michael, who lives in Wollongong. I'd flown on a Rex flight from Ballina to Sydney at 6:30 in the morning in June, so it was cold. I'd arrived, they picked me up in a car and drove me to Wollongong. And the whole time I thought that I was going to be taken to a studio and had my hair curl. I don't know what. I thought they were just going to, you know, make me turn 20 years younger. I don't know what. But literally I got out of the car in Wollongong. I'd never met Michael. I'd never met his family. I got out of the car. They started putting the sound gear on you.
Wait.
Yeah, I was. I was literally saying, where's hair and makeup? Where are we? What's going on? And they're like, oh, no, Daddy, it's not hair and makeup. This is, you know, this is a documentary. This is real. And if they told me that, I would have spent 5 minutes at the Sydney airport putting some lippy on. And I hadn't even done that. So it was a very big eye-opener to how the world really works in film and television.
So as you say, the first person that you met to work with was Michael. For people who haven't seen the show, tell me about him. What's he like?
Oh, he is such a fantastic person. Mike just wears his heart on his sleeve, and he calls a spade, and he's very blunt and very straightforward. And I think what's resonated with a lot of people is that Michael says things out loud that a lot of us are thinking, but because we socially filter, so we might not say these things so directly. And so Michael does that. So I think that he allows that connection with people because some of us go, oh, that's what I think. But the other thing is Michael is so determined. He's so determined to not just have a girlfriend but to have a wife. Like, this is a priority in his life, and he's gung-ho about it. And there's no holes barred. He basically states this and expresses it and is really determined to do that. Also, he's just a classic one-liner kind of guy. So they have been able to pick up, you know, the Northern Pictures, which are an incredible production company, but they've been able to pick up these nuggets. I think that's what you say, like little moments of wisdom that Michael says that are beautiful. So, yeah, he's one of those people that one day, if somebody really thought about it, they should make one of, you know, those coffee table books, like The World According
the
to Michael?
Yeah, that's,
yeah,
right.
That's what I think Mike should do.
You had to have that first interaction with him as a therapist on screen, in front of the cameras.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that first meeting, and what were you thinking? What were your impressions, and what were you thinking, okay, this is what I'll work on, or this is what we'll discuss together? What do you remember?
I remember walking up in his driveway and there was cameras on me. I remember that because that was, what was interesting, Sarah, is that when they film me with the cameras and I'm by myself, I'm very conscious of it. But as soon as I walked into the door and met Mike, it's like all the cameras disappear because what I realise is that when I'm with Michael and when I hang out with anyone I hang out with, then I immediately can just kind of fall into their space. So the cameras disappeared amongst that. I mean, I've got 30 years experience working with autistic people and people with cognitive disability or neurologically, you know, have neurological diversity. I said that word wrong then. That came out with my articulation. But I think that in my job, that's the biggest part of the job, is to create rapport with people. And you just have to follow somebody's lead. So, and what people don't understand is that I was in that house with Michael and his family for probably 3 hours. So, you know, television's edited. It would be very slow television if they showed the 3 hours of Michael and I interacting. But so it was a slow build. You know, you can slowly build up. But, yeah, the majority of it is you just follow what the person is wanting or needing. And in that situation, in actual fact, Michael's family, so Vanessa and Tom, really were wanting to hang around and chat about their experience. So it was kind of like almost a family gathering with me there to start with, and then they left, and so then I was able to, support Mike. And a lot of Mike's stuff at that point was what he was expressing at that point was that he was just running forward, you know, so that idea. Many autistic people that I work with have kind of an end goal, but there's part of autism which has to do with our executive functioning, which is our frontal lobe. So it's about planning and sequencing and knowing the small steps that we have to take to get to this end goal. And so Michael's particular presentation of autism is that sometimes he's seeing the end but not knowing what the small steps are to
I remember
get
you drawing those steps out for him.
Yeah. So in my job on a day-to-day basis, well, that was the other funny thing that the Northern Pictures people said to me, so, you know, do you need to bring luggage with you and do you need to bring lots of resources with you? And I was like, nah, because, you know, anyone who's been in their their profession for a long time, I can do things on the fly a lot. And so I just said, no, I just need paper and some texters and I'll be okay. And I think that shocked them a little bit that I was able to be in the moment so much on the television with each person.
As you say, you thought it might just be a brief appearance and disappear, but no, the show really took off and you were a really key part of it. Have you been recognised on the street?
Do you know what? I get recognised more for my voice than I do for my face. I mean, there's definitely been people. I mean, somebody hit me up in the supermarket yesterday and said, oh, you really look like this person from this television show. But more often than not, it's been my voice that has been recognised, which has been really embarrassing for me because, you know, I hate my voice.
No.
Yeah, I do. And I've actually had big self-esteem problems with my voice.
Oh, Jodie, but your voice is so distinctive, but it's so beautiful. Why don't you like it?
I don't know why. There's funny things about how we have images of ourselves. So I just think that as a young person, I don't know, I just think my voice is so odd and different and very Australian. And so people recognise it. But when I was a young person, well, I always tell people, she'd die if she knows I'm going to say this, but I have a very close friend and she wasn't a colleague who was a speech pathologist. And for years in our relationship of working together, I'd say to her, oh, I need you to be Professor Higgins to a My Eliza Doolittle. And I really wanted to have a voice that I think I had an image of myself that if you were really intelligent and really smart, then you had a voice that went along with it. And it just didn't seem that my voice was matching who I really wanted to be. But, yeah, I've had people literally in the street say, oh, are you Jodie from Love on the Spectrum? And I've said to them, oh, wow, you're so good with faces. And they've got, no, it's your voice. I recognise your voice. But in saying that too, Sarah, one of the things that they've told me that when it got to Netflix and that they were in discussion with Netflix, when they called me and said, oh, it's going to be on globally and it's going to be in 7 different languages, once again, my perception and point of view was that I would be dubbed. So I then started thinking about how glorious I was going to sound if I was French or, oh, what if I had this amazing Irish accent? No, they said, they love my voice in LA. Apparently, it is a hit. So I have to take back my self-esteem issues with my voice and just, yeah, suck it up a bit.
Michael was working on stepping out the stages to get to where he wanted to be in a relationship. Mm. What are some of the other skills, say on a first date? What do you work on coaching people with autism, like we saw on the show? What are the key things for a first date?
Sometimes I think that what happens is that first of all, we've got to remember that every single one of us on the planet have difficulties with this. And so we all have anxiety to do this. Some autistic people have social anxiety. So it's helping them actually come, you know, be able to move through that social anxiety if they would like to have a partner or even just practice dating or whatever, to be able to get out of their own home and move into that world or to meet new people. Sometimes it's just about putting yourself in a position where you actually can walk into a space and meet people, which is complex. But the other one I think is that first dates can be a little bit rote. I know that sounds a bit funny, but we have to overcome that first. Like in the recent season, I'd had to talk a lot to Tao about that in the first 10 minutes that we just have to allow people the grace of being kind of in this weird space because it's a strange environment. So overcoming that and then sort of knowing that it has to be about a shared experience and it's got to be about back and forth interaction. And it's like taking turns. It's like playing a game of snakes and ladders or Uno. I know that sounds strange, but on a date, it's all about, will you and I have enough in common that we should do this again? Or what is it about you that makes me feel good? But it's also giving you the opportunity to know me. So that's actually, you know, it's a really reciprocal interaction. And when you first meet someone, it's actually really complex and difficult to find a balance in that reciprocal nature. Because if I'm a little bit nervous, I might come in and just really go, oh, here's all the great things about me, Sarah, and let me tell you all about me. And then you're going to go, what? You know, back off a bit, Jodie. So it's a lot of what I do in supporting autistic people is to actually find the balance in how much do I say about myself. How can you be yourself and talk about the things that are really important and special to you? And sometimes autistic people, the things that they love are so amazing.
And they're so knowledgeable.
So knowledgeable. But sometimes the difficulty is that they're so knowledgeable, then they forget that the other person also is knowledgeable. So, yeah, a lot about first aiding for me. And just letting people know, like people were quite shocked. There's on the show, you know, Michael thinks that we as a society are slipping away from good manners, and he really loves formality and he really loves etiquette. So people are saying, some people have said that's a really full-on date for people to go out with autism on the first date. Michael
to be sitting in at a dinner
really
with a tablecloth
dinner.
And the flower.
But that is Michael's perception of what a date is. It is about taking somebody flowers and chocolates and going somewhere formal. You know, for some of the other of us, we'd go, oh, let's just go to the movies for the first time, because then I don't have to talk to somebody for, you know, I can overcome just even sitting next to them for an hour and a half. So you've just, it's part of it. My job also is, and on the show, is to help people be themselves in whatever space they need to be that in.
You mentioned perceptions, the ideas of what a date should be, and I think that's one of the really interesting things, because most of us bring some unrealistic expectations to romantic relationships. Mm. Is part of your job there as a coach to temper some of those fantasies people have about what romance will bring them, about what dating might mean?
Mm. And I think that it's still a societal thing. And for many people, not autistic, well, some autistic people, but I also work with people with cognitive disability. And one of the things that I probably hurts me from is the fact that we still live in a society where people think that if you have a partner, if you are with somebody, then that somehow equates to your sense of worth or your kind of valued status. And sometimes my heart it doesn't break, but it cracks a little bit when I might be sitting with a woman. Say I'm sitting with a woman with Down syndrome, and she says to me, if I have a boyfriend or if I have a girlfriend, then that will make me normal. I'm putting normal if somebody can see me in kind of, you know, whatever you,
inverted commas. Yep.
Will make me, because it is that thing to say, if somebody loves me, then that shows the rest of the world that I'm lovable. And I think that that is a really big setup for all of us, that we need to kind of change the priorities of what we're thinking of. Our sense of self-worth should be based on the fact that we are a good person, and it doesn't take being with another person to do that. So sometimes it's really building. Where I usually start from is somebody comes to me and they say, I really want to have a boyfriend, I really want to have a girlfriend. Often we'll say, first of all, do you have a friend? Have you got friendship skills? Can you name one friend? And the other thing I always look at is a person's own perception of themselves. What is their self-esteem? What's their sense of self-worth? What can they tell me that is brilliant about them? Can they speak about themselves with worth? And because if you don't have that, if you don't see yourself in that way, then in actual fact, you don't carry yourself with confidence. And if you don't carry yourself with confidence, then you're actually not attractive to other people. So if you want to attract other people to you, I just spoke to somebody about this yesterday, and I use it quite a lot. It's the difference between Clark Kent and Superman. They're exactly the same person, exactly, except that Clark carries his body in this way that's saying, I am not worthy, and his shoulders are hunched, and he's into Lois, but Lois just can't see him. But as soon as this same person is Superman, and their shoulders are back, and they're standing tall going, I am, you know, this. Lois is in there, but it's the same person. Yeah. Clark and Superman are the same.
There's those two sides, aren't there? On the one hand, it's this the self-esteem that you're talking about, and then there is that wider social pressure that a relationship is something that people have to have. I mean, I know it comes, there's an internal pressure and there's an external one. Mm. You know, I think Married at First Sight, these shows exist for neurotypically people, if that's the right term to use, as well as people with autism. So there's this clear feeling that so many people have that they need to be married or need to be dating someone. Mm. Is that true? Like, is that a genuine need you feel from your work as a therapist, or is that society telling us we should be in an intimate relationship? How do you find that?
Look, I think it's something that it's not for everybody. You know, I work with people that are asexual, where the thought of being in a relationship like that would almost be repulsive to people. But I think all of us, what I do know is that every single person desires connection and they desire relationships that are very intimate, where we can be vulnerable with another person. And of course, what we would say is the most probably, you know, the, I don't know the right words for it, but if you look at somebody being in a lifelong partnership with somebody, married or not married, whatever you want, but, you know, that kind of intimate, romantic, and then we also put on the monogamy of that for some people, even though that's not everybody's bag either, but we do hold that as being the most important status. But, you know, if in my work and in my life, I actually don't think it is. I think it's actually about just human connection with anyone, and it's about our connection with friends and family and even, you know, if you're lonely, if you're lonely and you feel loneliness, not being alone, some people are alone and very happy in that, but if you are lonely, then I think that is the most terrible, terrible thing. Like, that actually almost makes me cry just saying about people being lonely, because for me, it's not about whether you're married or not. It's every person in the planet needs to feel they belong and they need to feel connected. And if they just have one other person that they feel love for and feel loved, then that's what gives us the joy in life. That's what takes away that feeling of, yeah, I want, but I don't have.
Some of the social code that you work on with people that we see in the series and that you work on more generally, things like eye contact and the back and forth in conversation, are those skills necessary, though, if people are dating other people on the spectrum? Like, how
I
does
actually
that
don't
work?
Teach eye contact, so that's really interesting. So I don't teach eye contact at all, never have. Because I understand it doesn't take our eyes to listen. But what it does take is for a neurotypical person like you and I to get over the fact that if somebody's not looking at us, then they're listening. So, that's interesting. People, there's not one moment in the show I'd say to somebody, look at somebody in the eye. That's where you can see that people, autistic people, have been supported to have neurotypical body language. And what we need to think about is that if every single neurotypical person on the planet actually got over ourselves and said, oh, that person's not looking at me, but that's not how we are. We think, and you know, we've got Kath and Kim, look at me. We neurotypical people have a social interaction where we know somebody's looking at us and nodding their head at us, just like you're doing now, Sarah, that is encouragement to continue talking. So what happens is that if an autistic person is not giving us eye contact, they're not nodding their head, they're not, what our perception is that they're not engaged. And so that is our need. I have never, ever said to somebody with autism, make eye contact. But what I do teach them is a neurotypical person may perceive that you are not interested if you don't have body orientation or you don't have this or you don't have that. Now it's up to you and your choice what you do with that. Or can you advocate enough to say, hey, I'm listening to you, but I'm not looking at you.
What do you hope, Jodie, that people who are neurotypical will take from watching Love on the Spectrum?
Oh, I just hope there's some learning about how absolutely brilliant autism is and how diverse humanity is and how great humans are. And I hope there's just a bit of education that we become a little bit more tolerant and inclusive.
There's a lot of humour in the show. I think when I'm watching it, I tend to either be laughing or crying, sometimes kind of both at the same time. But before you saw the series, were you worried that for viewers like myself, it would be these people with their struggles might be something to laugh at, entertainment? Like, were you concerned about how people would relate?
Completely. I was, before I saw season one and I was sent before, I was so worried. I was so worried that it was going to be voyeuristic. I was so worried that how were these people going to be represented? I was petrified of what this would do, because after hanging out with autistic people for 30 years, I was really worried about the presentation. But, you know, I got to see it before anybody else did, and I was sitting in a hotel room. I was travelling at the point, I think I might have been in Wagga Wagga or Moree or something, and binged the whole first four episodes by myself, laughed and cried and went, that is brilliant.
Well, why is the laughter okay then for a neurotypical person? Why is it okay to laugh at Love
on the
Spectrum?
Because autistic people people are funny and they know they're funny and we laugh at each other. I don't understand. Like, we're not laughing at that person. We're laughing because it's funny and it's joyous. And, you know, autistic people don't walk around going, oh, it's all serious. Life is serious. You know, autistic people are people.
When you got to watch the final result and binge that series in your hotel room in Wagga Wagga, were you surprised by any of the dates? Like, you'd coach these people, but then you got to see what they put into practice. How did that go?
Both season one and season two, I've been really shocked because I didn't know what would happen on the dates. I only get the little bit. There was people that I was so amazed at how brilliant they were and how classic and funny and, you know, yeah, the joy that was in that.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Jodie, tell me more about you. Where did you grow up?
Probably my growing up years. I was born in Newcastle and spent some early time in Canberra, but my family moved to Tasmania when I think I might have been about 7 or 8. And we lived in Tassie until I was 17. So all of my formative years were in Tasmania.
What do you remember? What stands out when you think back to those years in Launceston?
Oh, just the freedom. You know, Tassie's a great place to grow up in. And I always talk about Tassie as giving me a really incredible love of history. If you grow up in Tassie, you know, you're connected with it because you even still are seeing bricks that have got the arrows and you can run your hands along them. So it gives you this deep connection of history and not just our white history, of course, but understanding what the history is of our incredible Indigenous people. But the other thing is that it gives you a really great love of outdoors and an incredible love of food. you know, in later years, I'd say wine as well. But but yeah, Tassie, I feel very fortunate that I grew up there.
And was there anyone in your family or friends you had at school who had autism?
No, I didn't know anyone with autism.
So how did you first become aware of this condition?
I was telling this the other day. I was speaking to my mum about it and said that in the last couple of years, I'd had this really weird sort of, not flashback, I'm not talking about that way, but I had this memory. I couldn't actually remember how old I was. I think I would have been about 11. We only had two channels at that point in Tasmania, the ABC, of course, and I can't even remember what the commercial one was, but we used to have Sunday afternoon movies, and I remembered seeing a movie, and I must have been about 11 years old. I like to picture that it was winter and I was eating a hot dog and mum was in the room. You know, I like to have these big sort of memories that fulfil all areas of my sensory need. But I can remember seeing a movie. I still don't even know what the movie was, but in this movie there was a kid that had really what they call classic autism in those days. I've seen the diagnosis change 4 times in my lifetime, so, you know, that. But I can distinctly remember thinking, what the hell is that and what is going on? Because this child in this movie was that very aloof, you know, rocking in the corner, non-verbal, and to me, and couldn't connect with people, and that was in the movie, which must have been in the 1970s. So I have a distinct memory of being really fascinated by that. That's kind of an early memory, but then later on, when I was in high school, so maybe about 15 or I think I was about 15, I always thought I was going to be an architect, which is really interesting because I really love drawing. I'm crap at it, but I really like that kind of experience of pen and paper, and did as a kid. Apparently mum and dad could throw me in a corner with some texters and I'd go for it. But when I went to do some work experience as an architect, hated it, hated being by myself in a corner with a piece of paper. And so I did some work experience. Luckily I had a close friend and his mum worked at a local special school. In those days, they were residential schools, and so I did some work experience at 15 in this special school with kids for disabilities and loved it.
Why? What did you love?
And it's such a weird question because I don't really know. I just felt like, probably there was this one moment where there was a little boy. In those days, people that had spina bifida, or he may have had cerebral palsy because he couldn't work, but they wore really heavy calipers, you know, kind of what, very heavy kind of almost metal sort of to keep legs straight. And I can remember he was really little, so I might have been about 15. We're playing something like Farmer in the Dell. I think I was helping him kind of move around. And when, you know, in that Farmer in the Dell, it kind of stops and everybody sort of stands around to see who's going to do what with the wife or the dog or the cat. I can't remember how the game goes now. But I let go of this kid and he fell over and he hit me. Like he fell, he knocked me over with his calipers. They were really heavy and I fell over on top of him. And he might have been 5, I was 15. And this joyous little face just looked up at me and he just said to me, "You forgot that I can't walk." And I remember that really clearly because I had completely and utterly forgot that I had this kind of, he had a disability and I was meant to be there supporting him. I just forgot. And I don't know whether it was those moments that have always happened in my life that I don't think... Ever since then, I love hanging out with people who think differently and perceive the world differently and move through the world differently. And it happened from that early stage that sometimes I just forget.
Were you known in your house as a kid as a bit of a sensitive soul, Jodie?
I think my mum and dad would probably say I was. I definitely...
Were you a crier?
I cry about everything. Anyone who knows me would say to you that my go-to emotion, I cry when I'm angry, I cry when I'm sad, I cry when I'm I cry when I'm happy, I cry. And I very readily shed tears quite easily.
What kind of things made you cry as a kid?
Well, I did get removed. I think one of my mum's close friends took myself and my sister and her daughter to see Bambi. And when Bambi's mum died when we were kids, I might have been about 4, I got removed from the cinema because when Bambi's mum died, I cried so much that I think somebody in the cinema said, "Get that kid out of there." I used to cry when Little House on the Prairie, even the theme song came on, because I knew that Nellie Olson was going to do something mean to Laura Ingalls every single week. So I used to cry for that. Yeah, I used to cry. I used to cry anything that was about other people getting hurt, I used to cry about. I don't like hurt in people.
As a teenage girl, you know, we all have different priorities or different concerns about ourselves as we move into adolescence. Mm. Tell me about the face cream that you saw an ad for and what you did about that.
I can't believe it. Talking a little bit more about self-esteem, and when I said my voice, the other one was when I was moving into adolescence, I'm very Celtic looking, you know, I've got lots of freckles. And when I was a kid, I thought beauty meant that you were meant to have completely clear skin. And so I used to cut lemons and rub lemons on my face because I'd read somewhere that if you rub lemons on your face, then you would get rid of your freckles.
Sounds like some Jan Brady advice. I reckon that's straight from the Brady Bunch.
Been something like that. That's probably exactly where I got it from. But because we were down in Tassie and, you know, the mainland was this mysterious place over the ocean, and we used to read Dolly magazine in those days. And I can remember seeing in a Dolly magazine there was an ad, you know, there was no internet in these days. You couldn't order anything online. You couldn't Google anything. You just had to, Dolly was true. And so there was a thing in there saying that there was a cream that you could put on your face. And in my mind, it was almost like a face mask. You could put it on and you'd pull it off and your freckles would disappear. And so I went to our local pharmacist or chemist who was just down the next to my house. There was these heaps of stairs, and I can remember walking down these stairs and going and trying to order this, get this ordered. I might have been about 13 or 14 because I just really thought freckles weren't great.
And what did the chemist say?
He was a really cracker of an old... He basically explained to me that this was character. This was... And do you know, it's another funny thing that... I've only thought about this now talking to you, Sarah, that my voice has ended up being something that allows people to maybe not see me as somebody who you know, is intellectual, allows that connection. But and also it makes me think about the fact that just having a really freckly face also, weirdly, maybe people just go, oh, yeah, she's not too bad. She's got a few freckles.
You know, and the things I could trust her.
Those things that we don't like about ourselves or we worry about as kids end up becoming the things that make us almost who we are and allow us to be, create that. You know, the things that you didn't like can end up being the things that you love about yourself.
And they're the little doorways in for other
always
people.
Always the doorways in, yeah.
How did life at home change when you were sort of nearing the end of high school? Where did your family move?
Oh, so that was a sigh, but it's still going, yep. So my parents moved to, so I'd lived in Tassie till I was 17 and then a term out, so the last semester of year 11, I think I was 16, about to turn 17, probably 17, my family moved to Canberra. And my elder sister stayed in Tassie. One of my brothers also stayed in Tassie for a little bit because he was on a water polo team. And so myself and my youngest brother and my parents moved to Canberra. So I entered a new school at 17.
And how was that socially for you?
Do you know what? It was so hard to move from Tassie. I was very angry. The worst, we went across the Bass Strait a lot, but that trip across the Bass Strait at 17 was probably the worst trip ever. My poor parents locked in a cabin with me at that point. But I did not want to go into a new school. I was 17. I was really frightened about going to a new school and what this meant. And so I said, right, I'm not going to school. I'm going to be a hairdresser. I'm going to drop out at 17 and become a hairdresser. And, you know, my parents are really smart people, really intelligent, and they knew me way better than I knew myself. And what they asked me to do was to go, just do the final term of school, you know, to just go. And if I did that final term or 6 weeks, I think they might have said, if I did 6 weeks and after 6 weeks, if I didn't like school in Canberra, then I could drop out and become a hairdresser. But what they knew is that I'm really social. So, you know, within the first week, I think I'd made some buddies. We went to an Uncanny X-Men concert or something like that. Anyway, I never looked back.
It's, you know, you say you're really social, so you're obviously doing that stuff that you're partly trying to coach other people to do. You must do it automatically. What is it that, what could you do in that high school full of complete strangers as a teenager that let you make enough friends to go along to an Uncanny X-Men concert and all the rest of it?
I think I'm really clever at context. So I think I'm really, it's my daughter and my nieces and nephews might say too good at it, in the fact that I can very quickly find a way to connect with, even if it's walking down the street. So when I'm saying that people, you know, my daughter used to ban me if we left the house, would say, only three people, Mum. But when I'm talking about context,
well, because you'd talk to as many people as you could.
I engage with everybody, Sarah. If I walk past somebody in the street, I will find a commonality in that moment to talk to them. I will find it. And this is what I don't think, but it is so easy to talk to people.
Don't you get exhausted by that? Don't you just have to come home and lie under a blanket with a cold washer on your face?
Look, sometimes people would, I don't. I think that I'm an extroverted introvert, so, and I really love people and I love connecting with people. And I don't think that we do it enough sometimes. I think that sometimes we don't know. We can change somebody's day. I always talk about the fact, and friends would rib me about this, but when I'm in the supermarket, I will deliberately, if I can't find something in the supermarket, I won't go and talk to the person that works in the supermarket. I will find the oldest person that can hardly walk near a trolley holding their shopping list, and I'll look at them and think, I wonder if you've talked to somebody today. And so I will go up and I will ask that person if they can help me, because sometimes we forget that we're not connecting enough, and sometimes a random stranger walking past and saying, you've got a great dog, or, you know, where'd you get your hat from, or isn't it a beautiful day? Sometimes that changes a person's day around. It changes mine.
You know, you're the kid who got kicked out of the cinema for crying during Bambi. How do you handle it emotionally when you're working with clients who might be much more isolated than the people we see on Love on the Spectrum, who might have you as their only point of contact with the world? How do you hold the the struggles and the pain of the people you work with?
Oh, now you're getting deep on me. Look, I've got good training to be able to do that. I've got really good training to be able to know that work's work and where the boundaries fit. And in saying that, I just said that, and then in my head I thought, oh, that's a bit of a lie, Jodie, because I do create genuine relationships with people I work with, and so it can be complex and difficult. And some people that I do work with have no other people, and I'm talking about no one. You know, they may be inside their house. They may not work. They may have social, they may have agoraphobia or social phobia and can't leave. And so I could be their only person. And that is a big thing to carry. But I've also learnt that I can only do what I can do to change the world with one relationship at a time. And so I don't go to bed at night sort of going, oh my God, I'm the only person in this person's life. I never ever go to bed like that. All I can go to bed thinking each night is that the world is a better place if we can allow another person to know that they're liked. And not just liked, really liked. And I really like the people I work
with. Do you, everyone?
Some people annoy the crap out of me sometimes, but I also have this incredible ability to I think people are good. I think that no matter how horrific somebody is, that you can find a connection with them. And so, and a lot of autistic people will do some clever things to try and push people away, really clever stuff that many other people would judge as being, you know, a lot of us, if we got the treatment from some autistic people, would just go, bugger this, I'm leaving. But what I recognise is that if you have a lot of social anxiety, you will do what you can do to make another person leave. So a person is only their behaviour, they're not the true person. And I 100% believe that you can find a commonality with every single person on this planet, everyone. It doesn't matter who they are or how different you are, you can find a thing that connects you.
One of the things that you deal with and coach with specifically is sex.
Mm.
How is that, how do you go about approaching that subject for people with disabilities?
So everybody that comes to me comes with a different reason. And so for some people it may be that they're very vulnerable. So I can work with people with a disability that they may, you know, statistically there's an increase of sexual abuse in people with intellectual disability. So I can work with people that have been abused. But I also work with people who have offending behaviour and everything in between. You know, I can work with people that, you know, I work with a person that has Down syndrome but is transitioning, which is interesting and complex and beautiful. I can work with people that are in relationships together and navigating just sex. And every person's different. We all go to a counsellor or we all go to a sexologist for a different reason, and it's as diverse as any other person in general population would go to a sex therapist or sexologist, except my way of working is I have to find a way to help somebody who learns differently or communicates differently or retains information in a different way. It's my job to find a method or mechanism for that person to have accessible information about sex and sexuality.
What do you think are some of the myths that those of us who don't have a disability have about people with disabilities and sexuality?
We still, as a general population, have this amazing image of what is sexual or what is sexy, and it's kind of separates all of us. Maybe it's me as the kid with the weird voice and the freckles that I was struggling against as well. You know, but we have this image that to be sexy, you have to look a certain way, you've got to be a certain way. And the further you are away from that, then it's really hard to have an image of yourself as that. And so I think that that's one of the things we're going to break down as well, that, you know, that's not what sexuality is, and it's not what sensuality is.
Well, what is it? How do you explain it to people who come to you? What is this mysterious bit of human behaviour?
It's everything. To me, sexuality is everything. It is the complete expression of yourself. So, you know, even how we use our senses every day to feel beautiful, which in turn makes us feel sexy, which then gives you sexual arousal, which then, you know, it's so big, Sarah. And this is where I get the greatest joy in my life. I have to learn every day about how diverse sexuality is and every single person's presentation of that, our desires and fantasies and intimacy and negotiation within relationships and how we explore what's sexual for us. And that's very different for every single person or your gender or orientation. But then at the same time, I'm also working with a group of people where their way of moving through the world is really diverse and different. So, you know, I've got to put those two things together on a daily basis.
How do drawings, you say you like to draw, how do drawings play a role in your discussions about sex?
Well, what we've got to remember is, well, I love drawing and I'm very visual, but a lot of people can't, or don't, learning through listening is not their preferred way of learning, and it's sometimes hard to retain that information. So, yeah, when people see me drawing, sometimes they're like, you are really bad, Jode. But what I'm trying to do is give like a secondary way of learning. So if you're trying to explain something just with your mouth, well, Australians know, I say this, every Australian knows what a mud map is. I'm just giving people a mud map of sex. That's all it is. I'm just drawing sex and relationships on a bit of paper with a texter.
Families, the families in Love on the Spectrum are so beautiful and they seem to be so supportive of their kids' quest for romantic love. Mm. But I guess there are also families who are scared, particularly maybe when it comes to sex and their kids with disability. Are they right to be scared? Are there different threats or dangers around people, the people that you work with when it comes to sexuality?
It's education. It's access to information. And I think we live in a world of fear at the moment. That's number one. We're all scared. But what we do, if we don't provide really good education and information to everybody, then we leave people vulnerable. And I can't express that enough, that if we do not share and we do not allow somebody with an intellectual disability to have an understanding of sexuality, then how are they meant to go out there in the world and be protected? And that's as simple as if you cannot give and gain consent, if you don't know how to do that. And so some people I work with don't know how to initiate a conversation. If you can't initiate a conversation, how the hell are you meant to ask somebody for consent? I talk a lot about the fact that we talk about sex as if it's one act of penetration between a heterosexual couple. And if you do not teach, if you only teach that and teach reproduction, then you leave people so vulnerable. This is stuff that we have to talk about with people. So families don't have to be frightened. Parents don't have to be frightened. They've got to realise that it's just the same as all of us when we were growing up. There was that fear of going, oh, if we teach somebody about condoms, they're going to go and use them. No, it's going to keep people safe because we've educated. Education's power.
I've got to ask, Jodie, as a relationship counsellor, as a sexologist, how's your own track record? You know, how's the dating world for you?
Up and down, like it is for the rest of us. I always say, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, when I was first on the show, they wanted to call me the relationship expert, and I refused. I actually said there is no way in hell that anyone on this planet can be called an expert, particularly a relationship expert. You know, relationships are up and down and they're hard work and it's a long life. And what I know is that I have incredibly brilliant and beautiful relationships. I am so fortunate and so lucky. And just like you were saying before, that I don't look at relationships as having priority in life of this or that or whatever. For me, I feel completely filled up with how lucky I am with the people that surround me. And I'm learning, like the rest of us, that these relationship things, they've got their ups and downs.
No, I can't help but think you must be further on that road of learning than most people. Even the conversations that you have with clients around consent or around gender, you know, that's a conversation that the general population is only still now starting to grapple with. Do you feel like you're a bit of a torchbearer for the future in some of the conversations you have?
I'm not sure that the young people would say that about me. I'm not sure that all the young people in my life will go, yep, Joan's a torchbearer for the future. I am learning every single day. Every day. I learnt this morning. I'm still learning about how that our understanding of sexuality and relationships continually changes. I'm learning that as we get more understanding of our own neurology, how much I've got to learn. I learn because I'm a human that every single relationship I'm in, every single social interaction I have, every single client that I'm with, I learn. And that's probably why, Sarah, I'm still doing this after 30 years, because I can see 6 to 7 clients a day and I learn every single moment of my day just how great humans are and how different we all are. And, yeah, I'm learning all the time.
Jodie, it has been an absolute tonic to speak with you. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hey there. If you love hearing the stories of extraordinary women, can I suggest another great ABC podcast? It's called Fierce Girls, and it takes you to a world of amazing Australian women. The trailblazers who had a determination to make history. Strong and inspiring female role models, we've got them. Fierce Girls, on the ABC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.